Today is Wednesday, June 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. and EU reach a deal over their dispute on airplane subsidies.
I remember very well it started when I got my first phone call by President Biden in February. And there we jointly decided to solve this problem.
Plus, Washington unveils its domestic counterterrorism strategy. And what are the implications of Beijing's incursion into Taiwan's airspace? We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden has wrapped up his meetings with NATO and European leaders, where it was announced that the United States and European Union have reached a five-year truce in a long-running battle over EU subsidies to Airbus, the main rival to American aircraft manufacturer Boeing. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen told reporters on Tuesday in Brussels that work on reaching a deal started months ago.
I remember very well it started when I got my first phone call by President Biden in February, and there we jointly decided to solve this problem.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Urban has been with the president in Brussels and shared the details with me.
Well, I think the best way to characterize this, Steve, is to call it a truce. It has some conditions on it. That the U.S. said certain things the EU needs to abide by for this pause in one part of their trade battle to remain in effect. But essentially, it extends for 5 years the pause in action by the United States that had been imposed in retaliation for subsidies that the Europeans were providing to Airbus, which was backed up by the World Trade Organization. Essentially, what both the Americans and the Europeans are deciding to do is to not so directly go at it against each other and reserve their firepower, so to speak, for confronting the Chinese. Now, if we're just talking about aircraft manufacturing, it's kind of interesting because the Chinese, of course, are not a threat, at least in 2021, to either Airbus or Boeing. But there's the potential in the future that, you know, China has aspirations to sell large commercial aircraft to foreign airlines. They haven't really made a mark in that area yet, but it is a strategic priority for the Chinese government. And of course, there's little doubt among people here in Brussels that the Chinese would be providing a significant support and subsidies to their aircraft manufacturers.
Steve, backing up to Biden's second stop on his overseas trip, it was not only to meet with European leaders, but also with NATO. Can you kind of fill us in, since you were there, how the White House is characterizing his stop and his meetings with NATO and EU leaders?
Well, both with the NATO leaders and the European leaders in general, President Biden wanted to demonstrate is it is going to be quite a significant change from the previous president, Donald Trump, who had his suspicions about these sort of multilateral engagements and alliances. It was America first for Trump, wanted to go it alone, didn't think the NATO members, some of them were contributing their fair share to the military alliance. And Biden has really been embraced by the leaders of the NATO countries and the EU as well. And they're being blunt, saying, you know, the previous 4 years was rough for us, and we very much welcome this change.
And finally, looking forward to Wednesday, the president has traveled to Geneva, where he will be meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Can you kind of give us a look ahead? What do we know? What can we expect once that summit happens?
There are going to be hours of meetings. And one thing that a senior administration official told reporters on Air Force One on the flight from Brussels to Geneva is there's not going to be any breaking of bread, meaning meals are not going to be served. So they'll be in the room without sustenance if this goes on for too many hours. We can expect both leaders, when they come out and talk to the media, are going to talk tough, but they're also going to talk about areas where they can cooperate. We have been told to downplay expectations. Don't expect anything major to come out of this, but there could be some positive words about entering into new talks about nuclear weapons and missiles, which, you know, everybody would welcome something like that. But, you know, Putin is definitely going to criticize NATO, and Biden is certainly going to criticize Russia's moves into eastern Ukraine, as well as express general concern about human rights. Whether he brings up the Navalny case in particular, we don't really know yet. And he'll also make comments that he, you know, told Putin to his face his views on how upset he is with cyber attacks and ransomware criminal operations emanating out of Russia.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief. He spoke to me from Brussels, Belgium. In Washington, the U.S. National Security Council unveiled its strategy against domestic terror on Tuesday. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland made the announcement, saying the two most lethal elements of the domestic violence extremist threat are racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists and militia violent extremists.
Our focus as members of the Department of Justice and as a federal government is to prevent, disrupt, and deter unlawful acts of violence, whatever their motive. As the national strategy makes clear, there is no place for violence as a means of resolving political differences in our democracy.
Joining me with the details and key components of the government's plan is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden.
Well, the actual strategy, as the president and several top administration officials and the attorney general of the United States have described it, is simply put, going after the violence. The administration announced this back in January, that they wanted to take a much closer look at domestic terrorism and what was going on in terms of the domestic terrorists seen in the United States and what was going and what they needed to do to respond to that. Back in March, the Office of the Director of Intelligence produced a report that warned that the most lethal threat to the United States, no longer the terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State terror group, but actually it was coming from homegrown domestic extremists, mostly those connected either to white supremacist groups or militia movements that posed a threat to and were most likely to carry out attacks or, in the words of the report, to try to engage in violence during the current year. So after doing what was described in various ways as almost a 100-day sprint, looking at the scope of the domestic extremist problem, which included stand downs for all the major military services, to look at extremism in the military even, the administration put out this domestic terrorism strategy, which includes four pillars. First pillar is to understand and share domestic terrorism related information, intelligence. The second pillar is to prevent domestic terrorists from recruiting or mobilizing others to violence. The third pillar is to disrupt and to deter any domestic terrorism activity. And the final pillar is to confront the long-term, what they call the long-term contributions, the root causes of domestic terrorism.
Those are the pillars. That's the plan. Did they unveil any mechanisms of how they're going to carry this out?
A lot of it comes down to better sharing of information, trying to make more funds available for programs that can, on the state and local levels, that perhaps can provide them with more information or give local authorities more of an ability, more of a capability to counter these threats as they emerge. Now, this is tricky when it comes to countering global extremism, global terror groups. there are charges that the U.S. government can use. There are tools that the State Department can use, such as designating groups as terrorist entities. In the United States, because of freedom of expression and the ability of Americans to say what they want to say about their political views, no matter how vile they may be to someone, there are limitations. And so it's a fine line. Some initial criticism even of this plan from humanitarian groups, from right groups, from the American Civil Liberties Union, for example, is that it doesn't take into account freedom of expression. There aren't strong enough protections, and they worry that government may overstep its bounds in terms of going after individuals who might or might not be dangerous.
Speaking of those concerns, how has the administration responded to concerns about how this plan may affect American civil liberties?
One of the things that top officials have been saying, including the Attorney General Merrick Garland, is that the idea is to, and the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, is that the idea is to go after the violence. It's to go after people who are using rhetoric, who are using tools such as social media. You know, there's follow the flow of money when it leads to a violent threat. And so that's what they're saying that they're going to focus on, and that they're going to respect that in the United States, you're allowed to have opinions, and that people can express opinions, even if they are to a good deal of the population, perhaps vile opinions, but that is protected speech. So they're trying to draw that line, and they say that they will look into further protections of free speech if it's needed. And so they're trying to throw that olive branch out there to critics who are worried. There are also critics who say, look, that the approach from the Biden administration is too much focused on what they deem to be right-wing extremists, and that not enough attention is being paid to left-wing extremists, to people who may be acting under the umbrella of Antifa or other organizations. So there's a lot of politics that is going to come out. There's going to be a lot of political discussion, perhaps even political bickering over how this is carried out. It's something, though, that the Biden administration is taking very seriously, that the Department of Homeland Security is taking seriously, and that even the U.S. military is taking seriously, going out of its way to do a stand down and do an analysis of the extremist threat within the ranks of the military itself.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Tuesday, Taiwan's government says China flew 28 aircraft toward the self-ruled island that Beijing considers a wayward province. The Chinese aircraft entered Taiwan's Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, and included several different types of aircraft, including fighter jets and nuclear-capable bombers. According to Taipei, it is the most significant such incursion. However, Beijing has made no immediate comment about the incident. Now, to better understand the context of this event, I spoke with Scott Harold, senior political scientist for the RAND Corporation.
Well, I mean, this is certainly the largest incursion. I believe it was, at last count, 28 different airframes, fighter jets, electronic warfare platforms, airborne warning and control. This is clearly an attempt to continue what China has been doing in the years past, which is intimidating Taiwan even in the military domain with a sort of gray zone coercion that stays below the threshold of outright armed conflict, but attempts to erode or degrade deterrence and push the boundary consistently. It comes, of course, in the wake of firm and repeated comments by the United States that the relationship that the United States has with Taiwan, even if unofficial, is quote unquote rock solid, in the words of Secretary of State Blinken. And you've seen recent U.S. joint statements with the Prime Minister of Japan, the President of South Korea, the NATO allies, all refer to peace in the Taiwan Strait as a high priority national security item for all countries involved. And I think it's quite clear that China feels that it is losing the narrative of being able to box Taiwan out and suggest that this is purely a domestic affair of the Chinese people. I think what people are around the world in leading liberal democracies are recognizing is that Taiwan's fate and identity are intimately connected to the security of the region, which is a national security interest of the United States.
You mentioned that this is a continuation of Chinese policy towards Taiwan, but I want to follow up with your statement on, you know, EU and G7 meetings that the United States participated in. Do you also, is it possible that this action was also in response to some of the comments made at the G7 and NATO summits?
I think it will certainly be the case that China's framing of this is that its hand was forced and it had to respond to attempts by outside powers to intervene in the Taiwan Strait. But what we know about the U.S. policy toward Taiwan is that the United States has always indicated that its entire China policy is premised on the peaceful resolution of the differences between Beijing and Taipei, and that China's approach to managing its relationship with Taiwan has been one of increasing pressure over the last 4.5 years, 5 years, irrespective of whether or not countries around the world were speaking up. And so it will certainly be China's, I think, approach to try to characterize its position as justified, righteous, and a reaction to provocations by NATO, the G7, the United States, Japan, Australia, and others. I think the reality is China has long coveted Taiwan and has been increasing its pressure on Taiwan despite the absence of a threat from Taiwan and despite Taipei signaling that it would be happy to talk as long as the terms are under the rubric of peace.
So moving forward, what do you see as possible larger geopolitical implications, not only for U.S. foreign policy, but other actors in the area?
Well, I think what you've seen in the last several months, even the last couple of years, dating at least back to late 2018, arguably even back to the early years of the last decade, is that Japan, which is clearly the most critical actor for Taiwan apart from China and the United States, Japan has been increasing its military capabilities, relaxing the constitutional interpretations and the legal constraints on its ability to use its self-defense forces to protect its national security, and increasingly recognizing that Taiwan's security is intimately linked to that of Japan. So I would expect that Japan, as it debates how to move forward with enemy-based counterattack capabilities, which you or I would refer to as long-range precision strike, cruise, ballistic missiles, and hypersonic projectiles or hypersonic glide vehicles, I think it's likely that Japan's capabilities in that domain will continue to advance and will do so at least in part with a recognition that it's possible Japan may become involved or may have to defend its interests in peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait alongside Taiwan and the United States.
That was the RAND Corporation's senior political scientist, Scott Harold. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte will not cooperate with an international criminal court investigation into allegations of extrajudicial killings during his country's war on drugs. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda has that story.
The ICC's chief prosecutor asked the court on Monday to open the case, which she has previously said could uncover crimes against humanity, and referred to a series of Reuters investigations in her preliminary findings. On Tuesday, families of some of the dead cheered the court's move. Normita Lopez's 23-year-old son was killed in 2017 when he allegedly resisted arrest.
If we filed the case against Duterte here, nothing would happen. Since he's the president, he can manipulate everything. He can do anything to avoid getting sued and imprisoned. When I heard the news about the ICC, I became more hopeful.
Philippine authorities say over 6,100 suspected drug dealers have been killed in the 5 years of the campaign, all of whom violently resisted arrest. Rights groups, however, say many were summarily executed. A series of Reuters investigations in 2016 and 2017 exposed some of the brutal deaths. A Duterte representative held a press conference on Tuesday.
I believe that the decision to move forward into a formal investigation stage is legally erroneous, politically motivated. It is legally erroneous because, in the first place, the ICC has no jurisdiction over the subject matter of crimes against humanity as alleged in her information against President Rodrigo Roa Duterte. Secondly, the case, even for purposes of formal investigation, is barred by the principle of complementarity. And thirdly, the investigation is not pursuant or in aid of substantial justice.
Duterte is popular at home and widely supported for his tough stance on crime. The Philippines ended its membership with the ICC in 2018.
Matthew Laratonda from Reuters. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Two Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem have been flashpoints of tension over plans to evict hundreds of Palestinians from their homes they've lived in for decades. This was among the reasons for the recent fighting between Israel and the Islamist Hamas movement in Gaza that left hundreds of individuals dead. The Israeli government considers this no more than a property dispute, while Palestinians say it is an attempt to force them as a people to leave East Jerusalem. Linda Gradstein takes it from here.
Jerusalem Palestinian Salah Diab looks at the house across the street from his Sheikh Jarrah home, where seven families of Israeli Jews moved in more than 10 years ago. He worries that he and his children will have to leave the home given to his family by Jordan in 1948. The dispute between Palestinian residents and Jewish settlers has been wending its way through the Israeli courts for years.
The settlers say these houses belong to them, but it's a lie. If they bring one document that proves it's theirs, I'll leave my house tomorrow. But they don't have any documents.
At the Jerusalem District Court, Palestinian families from another East Jerusalem neighborhood, Silwan, are also protesting plans to evict them from their homes in favor of Jewish families. They are supported by human rights groups and Israeli Arab Knesset members.
What's more natural than defending your home? And there are moving for eviction of Palestinians in order to bring settlers.
The right-wing extremist Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gvir set up a makeshift office in Sheikh Jarrah to show solidarity with the Jewish families. He says the Israeli court has ruled against the Palestinians since Jews used to own the property in these neighborhoods before the State of Israel was created in 1948.
The court has already made its decision, but unfortunately, the government of Israel is not enforcing the decision because they are afraid of the riots.
But Israeli human rights groups say the situation is more than a simple property dispute, and they argue the law discriminates against Palestinians.
Anything but a legal issue. It's a political intention by a group of ideological settlers with the help of the government based on discriminatory laws that we have, which is saying that Jews can return to properties they lost in 48, while Palestinians cannot.
The Israeli Supreme Court is expected to make a final decision about the East Jerusalem evictions in the next few weeks. Many fear that the verdict may lead to renewed unrest by Palestinians and their supporters, as it did just 1 month ago. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Iranians have a choice between seven mostly hardline candidates in a presidential election on June 18th. Reuters' Rosanna Philpott takes this look ahead.
One man not in the contest is set to reinforce his authority no matter the outcome. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's strongly anti-Western supreme leader. In the Islamic Republic's dual system of republican and clerical rule, the president heads the government, but reports to the supreme leader, the country's top authority. Clerical officials who vetted the candidates rejected several prominent moderates and conservatives, resulting in a field of five hardliners and two low-key moderates. Let's take a look at who they are. The frontrunner is Ebrahim Raisi, a hardline judge seen by insiders as representing the security establishment at its most fearsome. Washington described him as a member of Khamenei's inner circle. He was sanctioned by the U.S. for human rights abuses, including the 1980s executions of thousands of political prisoners. Iran has never acknowledged the mass executions, and Raisi himself has never publicly addressed allegations about his role. Saeed Jalili, a hardline diplomat, is fiercely loyal to Khamenei. He lost his right leg in the 1980s when fighting for the elite Revolutionary Guards in the Iran-Iraq War. Jalili served as Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council for 5 years, a position that automatically made him chief negotiator on nuclear affairs. Abdul Nasser Hemati is a former ambassador to China and a pragmatist technocrat who had served as Iran's central bank chief since 2018 for 3 years. Mohsen Rezaei was top commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, who led the elite force during the 8-year Iran-Iraq War. Mohsen Meralizadeh is a former governor of Iran's Isfahan province. The moderate politician was elected as first vice president in 2001. Ali Reza Zakani is a hardline lawmaker who was disqualified in 2013 and 2017 from running for president. He holds a PhD in nuclear medicine and has portrayed himself as the most capable candidate at fighting poverty and corruption. Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi has been a member of parliament since 2008. The hardline politician has promised to boost Iran's battered economy.
Rosanna Philpott reports for Reuters News. And finally, a report by the International Labor Organization finds 10 years after the landmark Convention on Domestic Workers was adopted, there has been little improvement in their work conditions. Lisa Schlein explains.
When the convention was adopted a decade ago, domestic workers were among the most undervalued, invisible members of the global workforce. 10 years later, domestic workers still struggle to be seen and recognized as people who provide an essential service. Data in the ILO report show the world's 75.6 million domestic workers continue to suffer from poor working conditions, low pay, and a lack of social protection. It finds for many, the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened their already difficult situation. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says domestic workers have lost their jobs or had their hours of work reduced in greater numbers than others during the pandemic. He notes many domestic workers are migrants, so their status in the country could be called into question if they lost their jobs.
Many domestic workers live in employees. They could lose their lodgings where they live if they lose their job as well. So behind the aggregated numbers, I think there is a sort of a deeper human impact which accentuates even more the suffering involved in the labor market impact on them of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The ILO reports domestic work remains a female-dominated sector, accounting for three-quarters of domestic workers worldwide. Ryder says women comprise more than 80% of those working in the informal sector, which makes them more prone to exploitation and abuse.
Informal employment is characterized by poor working conditions, a lack of protection, and so we find that the vulnerability of many domestic workers earning their living behind closed doors in private households is that vulnerability is magnified by this condition of informality.
Ryder says the crisis highlights the need to formalize domestic work to ensure their access to decent work and laws that can protect their rights. The report finds women make up most of the workforce in Europe, Central Asia, and in the Americas. However, it notes men outnumber women in Arab states and in North Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.